Welcome Frank Fascino to this radio program. And Frank has got a story to tell you that you probably have never heard, or if you have heard, it's been so long, you have forgotten about it. It is really, really is one of the best and most extraordinary and most revealing UFO stories ever in history. And you know how these UFO stories are so fascinating to listen to, but in the end, you're left not knowing much more than you did before, except that it was really, really weird. Well, Frank has gone into his story a little bit more deeply than that, you'll find. Major Donald Kehoe, back in 1953, said of this story, "Of all the eerie saucer stories, this is the weirdest. When the time came to admit that they were real, the slightest official hint of possible menace would be quickly remembered. From that angle, the Flatwoods Monster was dangerous, with its picture of a fearsome creature intelligent enough to build and control spaceships." Now, that was said in 1953. It is still just as true today in 2005, and that makes this 50-year-old story just as current as your last breath. Will you get a next one after listening to this? Well, I don't know. Welcome to the program, Frank Fascino.
Thank you, Whitley.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Why don't you begin? You are a commercial artist by trade, is that correct?
Yes, sir. I'm an illustrator.
An illustrator who became interested in something that is now pretty obscure. And when did you become interested in it? You don't sound like you were around 50 years ago.
I have some relatives that actually live in Braxton County in the vicinity of where this particular incident happened back then.
And what
12th,
state is this in?
It's West Virginia.
West Virginia.
And Flatwoods is located in Braxton County, and it's the central point geographically in the center of the state. And it lies 206 miles west of Washington. That's a very important point I just want to bring up now, because it's going to come into play later.
Okay. So let's go back, folks. Put on your time machines, and we're going to go riding back to the early 50s with Frank Fascino, who knows this area, so this situation so well, he probably feels like a time traveler at times himself. Frank, what was happening back then around this area? What was it like, and what sort of things were unfolding in their lives?
Well, first of all, and Flatwoods was a small little community of 300 people. There were some mills. People basically in this area lived off of the land. And on this particular night in question, on September 12, 1952, at approximately 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, there was a group of boys playing on the Flatwoods Elementary School. They were playing a game of football. And coming from the northern direction over their heads was this unidentified flying object that was about the size of a two-car garage if it was laid end-to-end. And it circled, made a 45-degree angle turn, passed over their heads a little bit over treetop altitude, skimmed the treetops, burnt some of the tree line, passed across and landed on a hilltop on the Bailey Fisher Farm, which was to the east of them. And what the boys did is they got together, they ran up the street, and they went up to the home of a woman called Kathleen May. Now, two of the boys, Whitley, this was their mom. They all met at the house, and some of the boys actually chickened out and went home. And in the long run, there was actually 8 different witnesses who went up to investigate and see what occurred on that hilltop up there, and they wanted to see what had actually landed.
Okay, so you have these 4 boys, Tommy Heyer, Freddie May, Edison May, and Neil Nunley, 4 very ordinary-looking boys. I'm looking at the excellent, by the way, Flatwoods Monster website. That's flatwoodsmonster.com.
And correct.
Yes, so you can have a lot of fun at this website, because Frank has had the intelligence to not only to write about it, like we just see, gosh, how many UFO websites are full of verbiage. This one is also got a lot of the original photographs and newspaper clippings in readable formats that you can actually read. Really takes you back into the incident. It's absolutely fascinating. Okay, so a bunch of people now go out to see what was out there, what was going on.
Right,
and there was next.
Okay, there was actually Kathleen May, who was 32 years old, and also at Kathleen May's house was a 17-year-old cousin. Now, this is important, too, because he's about adult age, and he was involved in this incident. So he and Kathleen went up to the farm with Neil Nunley, Teddy Neal, Ed May, Fred May, Ronnie Shaver, and Tommy Heyer. Now, the ages of the kids, Whitley, range from 6 to 14 years old. Then you have Lemon and May. So this group went up onto the Bailey Fisher farm and then walked up to the area. They walked across a big, wide-open field, and they were looking to walk about a mile to the back of the property. I'm trying to set the stage here for the listeners. Now, it's about dusk time, and they were carrying the two people in the lead were May and Lemon. They were holding flashlights, and they were looking up the very top back of the hill. Now, this hill, this is a very important part of the story, Whitley, because this hilltop was actually a cleared pasture, and it was level and flat up on the top. And this is where the object had landed, and it actually had stopped in mid-flight, hovered, and dropped vertically down to the ground. So this is where this group is going up to find out what landed. As they came up through the first field, they came up to a big metal gate. And when they reached this gate, they opened it up, and they all passed through. Then they wired it back up again, because cattle and a lot of wildlife were up in that area. And they passed through this particular gate. They proceeded up an incline, and this was a rocky little terrain path. And as they got towards a second gate, which was a wooden post gate, they started to notice there was a particular sulfur type smell that was engulfing the area, and it was permeating throughout the path in that vicinity where they were walking. They pushed on. Most of the witnesses got over the gate and proceeded up towards the back hill. Some of the kids hadn't reached this particular gate, and as the couple lead witnesses got up towards this tree, which was situated just to the left of the path, it was an oak tree, and it was approximately 75 feet tall. The witnesses started hearing odd noises, and the main witness, Kathleen May, she told me that it sounded like a burning noise, like a sizzling, like bacon that was frying in a pan. It was something that was very hot. And they moved a few feet close to this particular tree, and approximately 12 foot up in the air and back of this tree, they saw a couple lights. And these lights were spaced approximately a foot apart. And as they moved towards it, Kathleen and the Lemon Boy, they flashed the lights on them, and what happened is this figure lit up and it glowed, and it was called the Flatwoods Monster. It was a 12-foot tall mechanical type device, and it was actually hovering, as explained to me by the witnesses. And the sulfur smell was actually part of an exhaust system that made this particular machine hover, that passed in front of them from the left to the right, and it proceeded back down to the hill. Now, here's an important part of the story. Where the witnesses were looking up to the back of the hill, the object they saw was not there anymore. It actually had lifted off of the back mountaintop or hilltop, and it lowered itself into a valley down to their right. And when the 12-foot-tall Flatwoods Monster passed in front of them, it proceeded back down to its path, down towards the particular object that was sitting there.
Okay, so I don't know why you've stopped. What happened next?
Okay, I was waiting for a response from you to see if there's anything you wanted to ask me on that.
I'm here listening, but it's such a fascinating story. Just keep spinning it for us.
Okay. Well, the group turned around. They were pretty much in shock of what they had seen. They had no idea what they had encountered. And they were going up to look to see what had landed up on the back hilltop. So they all turned around. They ran back down this path. And the first gate that they reached was this particular wooden gate. Kathleen May told me she was so scared, she jumped over this gate that was approximately 4 foot high in one leap. The rest of the group had turned, and they all ran back down the path. Some of the kids, when they got to this, the initial gate, the metal gate, some of them climbed over it. Some of the kids went through it. Some went around it. They were so scared that some of them don't even know how they did it. They did it instinctively. But anyways, they got back down to the house. And when they got back down to the house, Kathleen May organized the kids. They were hysterical. They were crying. Some of the kids' noses were bleeding. They had fallen. They were all scraped up. And she gained control of the situation, and she called the local sheriff's department. And the sheriff wasn't in his office at that point in Sutton, which is the county seat of Braxton County. He was off with his deputy, and he was actually looking for what was called crashing objects that were going throughout the Braxton County area nearby. And from that point in the story...
So now there were objects crashing down...
Throughout Braxton County.
All over Braxton at that point.
Right. Already there was reports, and the sheriff was off running around town looking to see what these actual objects were that were crashing. And what I actually did, Whitley, in my research, is I started pinpointing some of the locations in Braxton County where there were sightings. And I actually found out that there was not just one particular ship in question, that which was the Flatwoods Monster ship that the boy saw. There was actually several different objects that flew in that vicinity, and in my research I discovered there was actually four different objects that flew over that one particular pasture area that night. Four of them. And what I did, the overall research that I did is I looked outside of Braxton County, which nobody else had done.
Yes.
And I'm from someplace. The Flatwoods ship was actually pretty much the end of its flight path. What I did is I looked throughout the whole United States from the northeast area all the way down towards Florida. And I discovered there was actually a UFO flap that night, and thousands of Americans actually saw these particular UFOs flying across the country over a period of about 18 and a half hours. And I went to the Project Blue Book files, which took me a little over 5 years to restore, put together, piece together, and try and figure out some flight path trajectories of these particular objects. Well, Project Blue Book had quite a few answers in there. What I did is I referred, actually, from some of the Blue Book files, I looked into some of the newspapers throughout the East Coast, and I found more locations of UFOs. And the inevitable answer given by Project Blue Book, the government explanation, was that what was seen was an alleged meteor that passed over Washington, D.C., and it was sighted for approximately 5 to 6 seconds. Yet I documented 18 and a half hours of UFO sightings that occurred that night from 3:35 a.m. in the morning until 11:05 that night.
So this is after they saw... It would have been 3:35 the previous morning from the time the boys saw.
Right, that was the first recorded sighting in Project Blue Book, was 3:35 a.m. in the morning of September 12th.
Now, did Project Blue Book make any comment on the Flatwoods Monster itself?
Yes, they did. Actually, in their record card, they recorded the Flatwoods Monster incident. And I'll read you, in part here, Whitley, the comments on the Project Blue Book 10073 record card state that the West Virginia monster, so-called, period, actually the object was the well-known Washington area meteor of 12 September, landing near Flatwoods, West Virginia. And that's when I started connecting the dots, Whitley, across the United States. And I started piecing together the trajectories of all of these objects. The hardest part about putting this puzzle together was finding the locations. And as I started researching the story further and further, I started finding more locations and more locations. And over the over close to 14 years of research, I was able to put together very tight timelines. And it's like, connect the dots. You take the times, the locations, and the vicinities where all these UFOs were sighted, and I just started putting together these flight path lines. And they were going on the whole night. They're in every single direction you can imagine, there were UFOs flying over the United States.
Good Lord. And you're the first person to put together the fact that it was a virtual invasion going on that night.
Yeah, it really was.
One of these strange things where there's a huge amount of UFO activity, and it doesn't amount to anything. But in this case, it sort of went on, didn't it?
Yeah, what I actually did, Whitley, is I have a map that's 8 by 10 feet, and I use that as my primary master map. And every time I got a new bit of information, I went through the Blue Book documents, and that took a few years of pulling out the different sightings. And I would plot points on this particular map. And it's gigantic. And then Stanton Friedman helped me, and he got some more locations through different newspaper articles that he sent me. And actually what he had were different articles from around the country that I didn't have, and what I did is I pulled out the information from those particular articles, and I plotted their points, and I connected the dots and tightened my timelines and trajectories even closer. And like I said, it was quite an adventure putting all of this together. And it's right in black and white, right on the maps and the times and locations, and that's how I was able to figure out the story of what actually occurred that night. And I believe the Flatwoods Monster incident was actually a rescue mission, search and rescue. And this particular object passed over Washington, D.C. that night, and it was reported on the front page of the New York Times, Willie, and it was called the Flame Over Washington.
Wow.
And it came over Washington horizontally, on a horizontal trajectory, and it came awfully low, quote unquote. And it was traveling from the east to the west. It proceeded 206 miles west of Washington, and it landed right on that hilltop in Flatwoods. And if you look at a map, you'll see how Flatwoods is on a complete beeline west. So it actually traveled across Washington and went and landed in Flatwoods. And it was damaged. It had pieces falling off of it. It was in flames. It was pretty beat up. And what I did is I actually tracked it through newspaper articles going west. And so basically what I did is I just plotted all the points and just connected all the dots. And I did that with several UFOs that night.
Now, let's talk about the monster itself. And there was a sense of menace connected with this, as you've said. Can you give us some specific detail about what was menacing?
Well, actually, let me first touch on what the monster was said to have looked like back in the 50s. And you could look in publications for the past 52 years, you see the same ridiculous looking drawing of a monster. And where that came from was a television show. In New York, Kathleen May, Ailey Stewart Jr., who was a reporter who wrote the story to the press, I interviewed him at length, and he's also in my New York on We the People. And a sketch artist sat down off camera with the witnesses, and he asked them what this particular Flatwoods monster looked like. And Lemon and May gave them the descriptions of it, and what the artist did is he interpreted it wrong. And he drew this menacing monster 12 foot tall, and he drew it in cloth. He had it making it look like a biological entity. It had an ace of spades shape covering over the top of its head. He had this particular, for lack of better words, monster dressed in clothing, and he had it wearing like a dress. Well, the big misconception of the monster with the dresses, Kathleen May had told the artist that going vertically around the lower circumference of the body looked like what were drape pleats. You understand what I mean? These pleated drapes that ran vertically down. She, a housewife back in 1952, trying to describe something, a machine that looked like that. That was the closest thing she could come to comparing it to. And actually what these pleats were, they were tubes. And this Flatwoods monster was actually a machine. But the artist did his rendition of it and made it look like a biological entity wearing a cloth suit with an Ace of Spades hood over the top of its head. The Ace of Spades hood over the top of his head wasn't made out of cloth. It was made out of metal. And in front of the particular covering of this hood was a plate that looked like glass. So it was actually like a helmet rather than like a cloth hood, like what would be called as a monk's hood. So this monster also had a drawing on that was done by the artist, and he drew it with scary looking arms and claws that extended in front of its body. Well, when I spoke to a couple of the witnesses, they told me that these scary arms and claws were non-existent. What was being described to the artist were antennas, and the antennas came off of the horizontal plane of the shoulder. So what the artist did is he did his interpretation, and he drew scary arms and claws on it rather than these antennas that extended off the shoulders. So what you have is something that's more like a shuttlecraft or a probe-type machine.
Or something
rather than a biological.
That something like a... like a space suit, excuse me, that was self-propelled in some way, that someone was inside controlling it. Or a probe, exactly.
Right, and what's interesting, Whitley, is I've been working on this story for about 14 years until my book was published. And when I met you and Gulf Breeze a few years ago, we were talking over on the side about the Flatwoods case, and you were the only person that I spoke to and all my years of research who had looked at me and said, Frank, I don't think this was anything biological. You said it was something that was more like a machine with probably something inside of it, which is interesting because nobody had researched to the extent I had and come up with that conclusion.
Well, it's interesting because I don't remember our conversation. Because when I'm at those UFO conferences, I talk to so many people, it's very hard to recall. I remember very vividly, however, about the Flatwoods Monster. And I don't remember you, but I do remember talking to somebody about it, and obviously it was you.
Right.
And, you know, if it's too bad that science doesn't go about this in a more organized way, because obviously there was something going on here that is not dissimilar to certain other cases where there have been apparent incursions that have involved something going wrong, and then a more extensive ET involvement in the area. I refer, for example, to the Rendlesham Forest case, where it seems as if something went wrong and the ETs were there to correct a problem that had taken place. And that Canadian incident, there was a book in my series about it, but I'm forgetting the name of that Canadian incident. In any case, there's a famous incident in Canada where a UFO plunged into the water, and there appeared to be some kind of rescue mission involving ships that are a recovery mission that involved ships that occurred afterwards that were where we were either rescuing or recovering someone connected with the UFO. So this does happen. Now, let me ask you this. Later in July of that same summer, there was an extraordinary UFO wave over Washington.
Right, on the 19th and 26th of that month, Whitley.
Right. Now, that was before or after this?
This was approximately 7 weeks after the Washington, D.C. sighting.
Okay, so this yeah, go ahead.
This is September 12, 52. The Washington sightings were consecutive weekends, the 19th and the 26th. And they also involved UFOs that were flying over the restricted zone of the Capitol. Now, here you go, about 7 weeks later, here's something flying in at an extremely low level over Washington, D.C., except now it's on fire and it's engulfed in flames and pieces are falling off of it. And it's damaged right over the same area.
Right. And now, was there anything else ever found, or any? Are you aware of any attempts, say, at military presence in the area is seeking something, perhaps some residue or remains?
Well, what happened, Whitley, is I was told that the West Virginia National Guard was up there and the following day and for weeks afterwards, because you have to imagine this little town of 300 people. When the story hit the Associated Press, this story shotgun around the world like wildfire. There were people coming over here from everywhere throughout the United States. There were foreign people coming here trying to investigate this. This was a really big story. Then when Kathleen May went on national TV, it amplified it even further. So there was an estimated 10,000 people that went into a little town inhabited by 300 within 4 to 6 weeks. That was an estimate. And the West Virginia National Guard's presence was known to have been there the following day and throughout this 10,000 people who went to the town. Well, I found out the name of the National Guard commander, and he still lived in the area. And I spoke to him on the telephone, and I met with him once. And he told me a little bit different story of the West Virginia National Guard's involvement. And he eventually let me videotape him. His name is Colonel Dale Levitt. He was retired United States Army. And back in 52, he was the captain of the Guard. And he told me he received a call from Washington, D.C. to take troops and go up the Flatwoods and to see what happened. And that's what he actually did. He went up there that night with troops, and they cordoned off the area. They came in through the back end of the farm, not the access road, because they weren't to make a disturbance and let anybody know they were there. And he told me what actually happened that night and my interview with him on camera.
And what did he say? Tell us.
Okay. When he went up there with his troops, actually, where they went first, Whitley, was to where these other alleged plane crashes and different crashes were occurring throughout the county that I spoke about earlier. The residents thought they were airplanes crashing.
Right.
He brought some of his troops into an area outside of Flatwoods looking for this alleged airplane crash. He told me him or his troops never found anybody. He broke away with a contingent of men, and he went up the Flatwoods. And when they went onto the property, they came through the back end of this property onto the farm. They collected samples. There were debris. There was oil that was actually splattered throughout the area. And this was actually from the machine called the Flatwoods Monster that was 12 feet tall. The oil actually had hit Kathleen May, the closest witness to the monster,
amazing. And you've talked to him?
Yes, sir. I spoke to him a few times on the telephone. Now, he was a retired colonel when I spoke to him, Whitley. It wasn't too easy to get this guy to talk, as you can imagine. The first couple conversations, he spoke a little bit to me about it. I actually went up onto the farm with him another time, and we spoke a little bit, and he told me a little bit of this and that, just enough to pique my curiosity. And then I pretty much hounded him to death, and I actually got him to go on camera. And it was no easy job getting Colonel Levitt to talk.
I'll bet not.
He finally did. Everybody that I worked with up there, Whitley, they were happy that I was working with them and giving this story a straightforward angle. And I reported the story, I recorded it, and I put it into my book as it happened, according to the witnesses. They were tired for the first 40-something years until I got involved in the story with the inconsistencies with it. There's been hundreds of different renditions of this story, and the news journalists and reporters and writers actually destroyed the story because as they wrote about it, they were putting the facts down wrong. They were goofing the story up. And with the witnesses were reading all of this stuff throughout the years, they just got sick and tired of this, and they got fed up. So what they did is they figured the best way to handle a story so it wouldn't be told inconsistently anymore, let's just be quiet because nobody's doing the job right. And when I got involved in the story, I actually showed them some of the Project Blue Book documents that I found. And that's when they started to become very interested in it. And being an illustrator myself, I sat down with a couple of the witnesses, and I actually drew up what the monster actually looked like. I didn't draw it very quick and very fast, ready to go on a television show. And something I'd like to tell the listeners is, these witnesses, I didn't interview them once or twice, Whitley. I spoke to them hundreds of times for hundreds of different hours. If I had a question, I could just get on the phone and I would call them up, or they would call me, and you know, we had a good working relationship because they knew that it was about time that the story should be told right.
And so you've told it right, and it is a remarkable story, and a story that it kind of disappeared beneath the waves of media hype and misinformation. And yet, in the same time, in those days, there was such a thing as media hype and misinformation about this. Now
well,
there's only the misinformation, because the media
right.
generally, if this had happened now, even the Washington overflights happened now, I'd barely even get a peep out of the media, because they've committed themselves to the idea that this is all nonsense, and the last thing they want is to publish stories that suggest the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
like I said earlier, an important piece is the New York Times stated that it was called the flame over Washington, and it
right.
prompted the people throughout Washington to get hysterical, because this is only a few weeks after the Washington, D.C. sightings. So
you know,
this story was squashed.
You know, the last time the New York Times published a rational story about UFOs?
In the
year 1977.
Hmm.
Since then, I don't believe that the subject has been mentioned in the paper, with the exception of a big debunking article about the Roswell incident when the Air Force explained it away with the crash test dummies.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, the Times gleefully bought into that. You talk about being shills for the government. You can't get worse than New York Times, I think, sometimes. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. So where did this go? Eventually it all ended, and we were left with a mystery. Or were we? What do you think now about this story?
Well, what I did is I went a little bit further than the Project Blue Book documents, Whitley, and they reported and recorded what witnesses had sent to them and the information. Then they pulled some information out of different articles themselves. And what I did is, using the primary locations where these sightings took place throughout the United States, as recorded in Project Blue Book itself, I went into the local newspapers and smaller publications, and I found more sightings that Project Blue Book wasn't even aware of. And what I did is I actually tracked the Flatwoods Monster ship leaving. It actually departed the farm. And I tracked it going through using topographical maps, plotted all the points, and it actually didn't leave Flatwoods or the vicinity that night. I should say it left Flatwoods, but it didn't leave the vicinity. It stayed in Braxton County overnight.
What were they looking for?
This particular object was damaged, and it was looking for an isolated area to land where it wasn't going to be bothered.
Yeah, I wonder why it was damaged. I mean, there's so many questions come up that if we only had people who were really willing to look at this seriously, like, you know, you'd think that a highly advanced technological object wouldn't get damaged, but apparently they do, and it doesn't. I've always thought to myself, the scariest, given all the UFO crashes we hear about, one of the scariest parts about being an abductee is the danger of being in a crash.
Well, I believe, Whitley, what I did is I took Flatwoods as the hub of the event, and then I spread back out. And I believe this object, as well as other objects, were taken down by the Air Force that night. And Flatwoods craft wasn't the only one that night. There was another one that flew over Baltimore, and there was another one that flew over the East Coast and headed southwest. The other one that went over Baltimore, I tracked it explicitly going across the United States. It went north, and the Flatwoods Monster came in west. So you have northwest, west, and southwest. Three objects. All of them were in flames. They had pieces falling off of them. They were damaged, and they all made landings and repeated landings. And they were seen by people throughout the United States. And these took place at different locations, different times. This wasn't that one meteor that was seen for 5 to 6 seconds. These sightings were going on for a long time that night. But because of the lack of communication and newspapers, small newspapers, big newspapers, nobody ever put the whole story together, Whitley. You just had thousands of sightings across the whole United States, and they didn't connect the dots, and nobody knew what was going on. People in Tennessee, North Carolina, Delaware, Virginia, Maryland, Ohio, Pennsylvania, there were sightings throughout all of these states. But back then, the newspapers hadn't put all the pieces together, and I was able to get all of these reports of these sightings and plot all their points and put all the trajectories down.
So do you think it's possible that the Air Force was actively involved in an engagement with these things?
Oh, I believe so.
On what evidence? Was there any evidence of planes being scrambled at that night or at that time that you're aware of?
Well, what I did, Whitley, is when I started up in the area of Braxton County, and I started working my way north, then south, I started finding more sightings. And when I got down in...
If you could get exactly what you wanted in a planter, it would give you unrivaled speed, so you could blow through tight plants.
Florida, I actually found some crazy things that went on with jets. Right out of Tyndall Air Force Base, there was a pilot who ejected out of his aircraft and sent his $500,000 jet flying out to the Gulf of Mexico. Then I also saw another article that led me on an 8-year investigation into looking for two young men who were Air Force pilots. And it was an F-94 Starfighter jet that disappeared off the face of the Earth approximately an hour and a half before the Flatwood ship landed. And I searched high and low through the government archives, dealing with the Air Force, trying to find out what happened to this jet, what happened to the two men, and there are no records outside of the newspaper articles in the government archives of this disappeared jet or the two men.
So a jet disappears. Obviously, some kind of huge military operation is involved. And does Project Blue Book mention it?
Now, there's a lot of things that weren't listed in Project Blue Book. You know, even the simple point of locations of sightings throughout the United States. They were there were three states that weren't even listed that had several sightings within them at different locations that weren't even put in Project Blue Book. We're very lack of better words, non-investigative. Project Blue Book listed eight different states. During my research, I found out there was three additional states, Ohio, Delaware, and Tennessee, that had sightings that weren't even picked up and put into their lists. So you have a lot that happened that was in Blue Book and a lot that wasn't. And by working with the witnesses through other newspaper articles, I was able to formulate and retrace and what I believe was an encounter with UFOs and jets that night.
Okay, so what we're looking at here is probably the most extensive UFO encounter on record, including a crashed object, possible Air Force, probable Air Force involvement, many, many states involved, culminating in an elaborate incursion over Washington, D.C., arguably one of the most extensive UFO experiences ever happening in July of 52. Now, do you see any official denouement? Was there anything that surfaced in your research that suggested how the government may have reacted later? I mean, this must have meant a lot to certain people.
Absolutely, but as far as my research and Project Blue Book documents, there's nothing else written up about it besides a few other articles where they kept track of some of the investigators who researched this. Project Blue Book kept tabs on Ivan T. Sanderson, who investigated the case, Gray Barker from West Virginia, and Donald Keough. Donald Keough is the man who, that quote that you read earlier, he actually spoke to Albert Chopp, who was the liaison who spoke from the represent the Air Force and gave Keough a lot of the answers, because Keough didn't buy into the meteor theory at all.
No, of course he wouldn't buy into the meteor theory. He wasn't that stupid.
Right.
So,
but the past investigators were kept tabs on by Project Blue Book, because there's actually excerpts and pages torn right out of books that are in the Blue Book documents following the different people who looked into this case.
Well, it is really an absolutely amazing case, and you know, it happened back in the 50s, and subsequently there have been UFO flaps, but never anything, I don't think, on this scale. Are you aware of any flaps that were as big since then?
Not really, Whitley. This case was unbelievable, and most of the answers that I found were right in the Project Blue Book documents. If you got a second, I'm going to run over a quick list of the different states that were just involved in this that were actually recorded in Blue Book. There were sightings in Maryland, Virginia, Washington, D.C., Illinois, California, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and North Carolina. I found sightings also in Ohio, Delaware, and Tennessee. An interesting point that you can read about in the book is the two other UFOs that were damaged actually passed near and were headed towards Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Wow.
And the third one.
Now,
flew
when you say damaged, what do you mean?
These objects came in over the United States. They were engulfed in flames, pieces falling off of them, making the different turns, unlike a meteor, flying at treetop level, then ascending, then descending. You know, these things were wrecking.
Like classic aircraft in distress.
Yes. And one of these objects actually flew through the restricted no-fly zone headed towards Oak Ridge. And I plotted the point of this object going right through that particular area. And the other object that flew over Baltimore was sighted right across the whole United States and was heading up toward the vicinity of Wright Patt in Dayton, Ohio. So your meteor theory has three different objects seen at different times headed towards military installations.
This absolutely amazing.
That's why the story was covered up. And like I said earlier, how I plotted these points, some of the information came from Blue Books, some came from the actual witnesses I worked with, and some came from newspaper articles. So this was ongoing of well over 10 years of pulling information together and plotting different points across the country.
And so,
these are the flight paths I came up with.
So the question has to be asked, it looks like something attacked us, going after military bases, being resisted by the Air Force. And
yeah,
did we win or lose, Frank?
In the long run, I don't know exactly what would have happened if these UFOs had kept going towards their two designated targets. Oak Ridge, one was heading towards Oak Ridge, the other one was heading towards Wright Patt. They stopped and landed short, and then they turned around and they all left. And the last object that came in was your flame over Washington. So you have one going towards Oak Ridge, second one's going towards Wright Patterson, the third one came over Washington, proceeded 206 miles west, and when this thing was not intercepted or taken down in the vicinity of Washington, the other ones landed and took off, and then proceeded in the opposite direction. And then shortly thereafter, there were sightings from the southern United States going into the direction of Flatwoods. And this is what I believe was the rescue mission to go in and pick up the damaged one. The Flatwoods ship was the most damaged object that had the shortest flight path. And this is where the 12-foot monster came out. That's why I believe it came out of the craft that was heavily and extensively damaged, Whitley.
Well, Frank Fascino, this has been really extraordinary. His book, The Braxton County Monster, gets into all of this. It goes far beyond what happened in Braxton County on that night. One of the most extraordinary UFO stories, and I do have to say, expertly, beautifully researched. It will open your eyes. It will raise them in wonder. This is Whitley Strieber. This has been Dreamland. Next up, Linda Moulton Howe. One reporter who loves mysteries is radio's leading science journalist, Linda Moulton Howe. She's an Emmy Award-winning TV producer, documentary filmmaker and writer, and the reporter and editor for EarthFiles.com, the Internet's most respected edge science website. Today, she has a report for us from Oxford, England, where scientists are saying that global warming temperature increases could be much faster and much greater than any model so far has shown. Here she is from Albuquerque, Linda Moulton Howe.
Thanks, Whitley. You know, while the world has a new consciousness about the danger of tsunamis in the oceans and the need for better warning systems above us in the atmosphere, another danger increases and warning calls are being sounded more loudly than ever. Yet, the warnings seem to be ignored by the United States, Australia, China, India, and Brazil. That danger is the ever-increasing amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases building up around our planet and making it warmer. This week, scientists at Oxford University in England announced that their climate modeling experiment indicates that greenhouse gas emissions could cause global temperatures to rise by as much as 11 degrees Celsius. That's 20 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of this century. That would double previous computer model estimates about temperature rise as CO2 increases. The experiment is using the website climateprediction.net, which was launched in 2003, to utilize as many individual PC computers as possible around the world to increase analysis power of all the satellite and other data. Dr. Miles Allen in Britain's Meteorological Office said about the latest climateprediction.net analysis, quote, "The danger zone is not something we are going to reach in the middle of this century. We are in it now," unquote. Ironically, this UK warning comes only 2 weeks before the Kyoto Protocol is supposed to go into effect on February 16th. The treaty needed ratification by 55 industrialized countries, but five of the biggest polluters, the United States, Australia, and potentially China, India, and Brazil, have refused to sign. Finally, 3 months ago, on October 22, 2004, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed up as the 55th industrialized nation. So this month of February, according to the treaty, ratifying nations are supposed to start limiting greenhouse gas emissions as early as 2008. But the United States accounts for nearly 40% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. If it does not lead the effort to reduce industrial and motor vehicle carbon dioxide emissions, what practical hope is there that global warming can be slowed? This week, that question provoked the UK's environmental minister to appeal to the United States to join Great Britain in trying to limit CO2 emissions. Simultaneously, this week, three think tank institutes released yet another proposal to the United States, Australia, China, India, and Brazil. This new recommendations of the International Climate Change Task Force, as it's called, has been led by British Member of Parliament Stephen Byers and the UK's Institute for Public Policy Research, along with England's Prime Minister Tony Blair. Contributing to the task force recommendations is the Australian Institute and Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. This center has existed for only about 18 months. Its president and CEO is John Podesta, former chief of staff for the Bill Clinton administration, who has apparently reached out to Maine's U.S. Senator Olympia Snowe to personally brief the White House on the Climate Change Task Force's goal, quote, "to prevent global average temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius," that's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, "above the pre-industrial level," unquote. That would be limiting hugely the projected amount of temperature increase over the next century, if that's possible. This week, I asked Anna Unruh Cohen, Associate Director for Environmental Policy at John Podesta's newly formed Center for American Progress, how the task force planned to approach the Bush administration.
We felt that politically the Bush administration might feel more comfortable working within the auspices of the G8, and so the idea is to form a small working group of the G8 countries, so the major economies of the world, as well, and invite in for work on this climate group India, China, Brazil, possibly some other developing world economies.
Have you gotten any signal from the Bush administration that they would be willing to try join in this effort to limit CO2?
The Bush administration hasn't made any comments, as far as I know, about the report. We think that some of the technology partnerships they might be interested in. They've obviously been supportive of sort of clean coal research and development here in the United States. I'm sure, you know, Tony Blair, as he prepares for the G8, which is going to happen this June and early July in Scotland, will be talking with the Bush administration and trying to lay the groundwork for some of these recommendations to possibly be undertaken at the G8.
Does American Progress submit this meeting the climate challenge recommendation list to any particular person in the administration?
I don't think, well, I believe Senator Snowe has plans to brief the White House on the recommendations. We've also, in conjunction with Senator Snowe's office, sent the report and the recommendations to the Senate and the House of Representatives. So, you know, some of the recommendations already, you know, are already, the legislation exists that could already implement some of the general points of the recommendations. So we hope that the report helps facilitate that. And in areas where there isn't sort of current legislation along the same line, hopefully we might inspire some senators and members of Congress to take up that challenge.
What if it's too late? What if the greenhouse gas CO2 buildup is slightly out of control and will get worse?
Well, I think the task force members already recognize that, you know, we're already seeing impacts of climate change. They felt in setting the 2 degree Celsius target that above that the impacts can become significantly more serious, and the risk of abrupt climate change is increases. And so I think they were trying to stay positive. I mean, the overarching message of the report is that climate change is a serious issue. We need to take action now, but there are actions that we can take that both address the problem and are economically viable.
You can see all of this task force's recommendations that they want the United States and India, China, Brazil, and Australia to consider embracing at my website, www.earthfiles.com.
Thank you, Linda, for that report. Next week on Dreamland, Science and the Akashic Field, Irvin Laszlo, one of the leading physicists of the world, is going to be with us, and he's going to be saying that the new discoveries indicate that the universe must have a memory that contains essentially everything that happens. The Akashic Field is quite real. Amazing stuff next week.